You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to and watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Today is March 10th, 2021. Well, got a person on with us who really needs no introduction at all. You've all seen him many times. You know him quite well. And I'm talking about Rick Rule. We just all, if you're on his email list like me, you got a note, a nice email saying, hey, I'm moving on now. I'm going into another phase of my life. And, you know, I wanted to have Rick on because of all the people I know in this business, by far one of the most gracious people, the most generous person, especially with his time. He'll always take time out to talk to you no matter what's going on. And that's something that I'm personally grateful for. And Rick, hey, I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but if you were starting out today, what are the top three things that you learned in your illustrious career that that would have kind of paved the way starting out again?
I think the first is not worrying about making money, but rather worrying about delivering utility. As a young man, I worried about making money, and I'm not trying to say that money isn't a good thing. But when I stopped worrying about making money and started worrying about delivering utility for other people, within a quarter, my income doubled and my satisfaction went up tenfold. I think it helps, too, to be curious. I have found in my life that I've been aided by an abiding curiosity, which has meant that all of the study, all of the work I've done hasn't been work. It's all been pleasant. When I'm competing against somebody who believes that their economic activity is some distasteful thing they do to support their lifestyle, of course I beat them because it's a passion for me. And I guess if I had one more thing to say, which I haven't done too well at for the last 10 years, it's to read maybe 2 hours a day outside your directly chosen field. One of the things that I intend to do now is spend 2 hours a day really beginning with the classics and moving forward, something that isn't about finance or mining. So I think that's what I would say.
Yeah. Well, what you say, like, you know, people always say, follow your passions, you know, follow your passions, do what you love. You'll never work a day in your life. And all those things are true. But you got a family, you got obligations, and you can't just pick up, or you believe that you can't just pick up and do what you want. Then you wind up, and I know I felt this myself for many years, of being trapped in a place I didn't want to be, doing a business I didn't want to do. And really, it's really the secret of being miserable is just doing something you don't want to do for the money. But on the other hand, people will say to you, and I'm sure if you talk to younger people, it's like, yeah, that's easy to you for you to say, you're on top of the world, you did all this. And, you know, people look and think, oh, you know, you're just naturally successful. And really, I can't do what you do. What do you respond to that? How do you address that objection, if you will?
I think if you have a plan, it's okay to do stuff that's suboptimal if it's part of the plan. As an example, I put myself through university owning a bar, you know, working at a bar, bouncing, and then owning a bar. And I was relatively successful at it. I understood that I couldn't be a capitalist if I didn't have any capital. And so owning a bar, operating a bar successfully, gave me the capital I needed to start the rest of my business. I hated it, but it was tolerable because it was part of my plan to get where I wanted to be. So I understand that you don't get to start life on top. And I understand that there are some aspects of getting to the place where you want to be that are objectionable. I also understand, by the way, that for a lot of people, financial success isn't necessarily a driving goal. They have other forms of success, lifestyle success, family success, philanthropic success that are more important to them. And that's all great. That's really, truly all great. But the idea that you can achieve real success in an endeavor that doesn't appeal to you is difficult for me to imagine.
Hey, you know, I lived in New York a large part of my life. I really never liked living in the state for a variety of reasons, mostly economic, but economics always comes out of politics. It's basically a socialist state, and I felt like I had a target on my back. The more I'd succeed, the more they'd reach into my pocket and take my money. And yet the business was there, and I felt children's lives were there, had to do it. So, but it was all part of the plan to get out of there one day, which, you know, I'll just never forget getting into the SUV with all my worldly possessions, driving out of New York, never go back there again, I hoped. And so far, so good. When you look at people now and all the issues in so many states, so I guess having that plan is really essential, isn't it?
I would think so. I think that you can get through periods that are distasteful to you if you understand that probably they're finite and they are part of achieving something better. That's precisely how I looked at the bar business. And it's also how I looked at a period of time at the end of the decade of the 1970s when I went from being a fairly rich guy to being having a negative net worth, that is to say, being sub-zero. I was able to view it as a setback, and I was able to understand that if I kept my wits about me, kept working, kept my reputation intact, that this too would pass. You know, all of us are going to have setbacks, but I think if we have a grander plan, a real plan, and a vision, that those interludes, those unpleasant interludes, become, first of all, just that, and they also become tolerable.
And that's such a great point of, you look at your net worth, and your net worth isn't where you want it to be, or it could be negative, as in your case. I've had my back up against the wall as well, and the thing that always got me through is life. Everything in life is temporary, and you go through a bad period, but you have to learn. I think it's nature's way of making sure we don't get too prideful, get too big a head on our shoulders, and B, pain is the ultimate learning motivator, right? How did I get in this mess? How am I going to get out? And how am I not going to repeat it? I always like to say I've made four fortunes, lost three and a half of them along the way, only because the last one I had learned from the first three that I managed to hold on to something and hold out for better days. And nowadays, though, you look and the world feels so much more uncertain maybe than it did when we were younger. And maybe it is and maybe it's not. But when you look at the millennials and they're saddled with debt and job prospects are bleak and they got to work from their home and they can't interact with their friends, you might tend to think that things are worse now perhaps than they were in the 70s.
I've thought a lot about that, Kerry, and I am certainly in a sense embarrassed when I talk to millennials about the, you know, $140 to $160 trillion on balance sheet and off balance sheet federal liabilities we're handing to them. I mean, this is a wonderful income transfer from them to us. We voted ourselves all these cool benefits and we're sticking them with the bill. You know, on the other hand, we went through some interesting stuff too. I'm thinking in particular about, as an example, the war in Vietnam. That turned out to be a benefit to me because it caused me to move to Canada. And it also taught me in my teens that the government wasn't my friend. But there were some tumultuous times in the late 60s and early 70s, street violence, racial antagonism of a type that dwarfs the racial antagonism that we're seeing today. You know, there were, I think every generation's gone through something. I remember in the late 60s, sort of maybe over-dramatizing the situation that was facing me. And I remember talking to my grandfather. And he says, you know, we had some challenges growing up, too. The Great Depression, World War II. So I suspect every generation has their crosses to bear.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is true. And I just think back to a quote from Eisenhower, who was in a way as much of a philosopher as Yogi Berra, when he said things are more like they are today than they've ever been before. And here we are. We got this mess on our hands. We've got, you know, just more problems. And yet when COVID hit, I looked at it a lot differently than I looked at the financial collapse of 2008 and 2009, where I thought the world was ending. this time, you know, I said, oh my God, this is the most incredible opportunity that I have ever had in my later life here. And I'm going to make the most of it. And it's been an amazing experience. I mean, this has been one of the best years of my life. Strange as that may seem, I didn't enjoy the lockdowns and the restrictions on freedom and all this and feeling that the world's heading in the wrong direction. But the ability to separate yourself from the madness that's going on you, from the negativity, and still plow on. It took me a long time to understand how to do that. How did you come about becoming the master of your internal mental fate?
I think, like you, the school of hard knocks. The circumstances come about and you learn how to deal with them, or you fail. With your own business, which I would describe as informal broadcasting, the fact that COVID kept your audience at home focused allowed you to turn lemons into lemonade. You know, not a bad circumstance when you think about it. I know that you didn't plan when you set out to do what you're doing today that all of a sudden your audience would be confined to their home and have to listen to you. But the truth is it ends up for both of us in that sense, being a wonderful blessing. For me, for the last 40 years, every 10 days I've been on a plane. And at age 68, I feel physically better than I've felt for probably 15 years, simply because the wear and tear on my carcass from being on a plane every 10 days is gone. I look forward in semi-retirement now to doing some travel again with my wife, but without a mind tour or a conference appended to it. The idea that I can do a conference and talk to 1,000 or 2,000 people from my house via hop-in or Zoom, that I don't have to subject my carcass to a flight. I don't have to subject myself to the indignity of the Transportation Safety Administration or Customs. The fact that I don't have to check into yet another hotel, which, while however nice, isn't my home. All of that to me is an unalloyed blessing. And so, in a sense, like you, I would say that COVID has been a strange blessing. Partially, it's been a strange blessing for both of us because we've been adaptable enough to morph what we do to sort the circumstances that we've been given.
And that is such a great point, Rick. I look back at my two grandfathers. One I never met. He was gone long before I came on the scene. The other one I knew quite well. And one of them was high on the hog before the Great Depression hit. And he never really recovered from it, never was able to change his mental state, his mindset, to really adapt and prosper. My other grandfather became wealthy during the Depression because he figured out that the government wanted to build stuff. And he was known as Honest Abe. He always came in ahead of schedule and under budget. And they needed him so they could handle all the other corrupt projects and nobody was watching them. And really that among us and about what's going to happen in the future with our monetary system, whatever, there's a lot of people who are never going to get over it. They're never going to be able to recover from COVID, from the lockdowns, losing your business, losing your job, well, they haven't lost their homes yet because they don't have to pay for them now. But that's kind of inevitable that gravy train's going to end. And really, to me, that lesson of the Depression, it also fed my fears. I always had this fear of dying alone and dying broke, an unrealistic fear, but a fear nonetheless. So I guess these hard times really help you overcome your fears and your insecurities if you allow them to teach you that.
You made several interesting points there, Gary. Fear and insecurity, if they don't paralyze you, are good things. Fear means that you are spotting potential risks, and if you use the fact that you've spotted them to do whatever you can to alleviate the inconvenience that they may cost you is a very good thing. And insecurity, that is competing against yourself, never resting on your laurels, is also a good thing if that insecurity doesn't paralyze you. It's interesting when I talk to people about those two topics, fear and insecurity, they're, at least in a measure, not character defects at all. They're beneficial, I think, over time. I realize it's unpleasant to go through them, but life isn't always supposed to be all pleasant.
Yeah, very, very true. And fear can be a great motivator. Insecurities, you know, we all have them. No matter how, what your station in life, you're going to have insecurities. The key, like you said, is not being paralyzed, not being controlled by them, not allowing them to stop you from growing. And really, talking of growth, all right, so you've accomplished probably virtually most of your goals, 99% of them. Now you're going to be a competitor, in quotes. You're becoming all media, Rick Rule media personality. Not, you have been all along, let's face it, but now you're actually focusing on that part. Do you have any fears about the road ahead?
None at all. You know, from an economic point of view, I've been very lucky and worked very hard. So in the highly unlikely event that I failed in that endeavor, it wouldn't change my decision as to what to have for breakfast. The fact that I've been reasonably successful in alternative media in the last 5 years, being constrained by securities regulation as a licensed person, my suspicion is that if you take those constraints off me going forward, which they will be, that I will be able to deliver more utility to various audiences, yours included, hopefully, than I've been able to in the past. And if I think about the fact that I've been reasonably successful as a teacher, not being allowed to teach, that I'll be able to be more successful as a teacher if I'm allowed to teach. And that's part of what this retirement is about. I'm giving up regulated activities within Sprott.
Yeah. And like we were talking about pre-call, those are the most aggravating, annoying things, the things that you least look forward to during your day. So you're getting rid of like the source of most of your negativity in a day because you're dealing with stuff that as a recovering attorney and you know, a recently out of retirement attorney, and that's a whole nother story in itself, but not to practice per se, you know, they could just drive you mad. And you spend half your day trying to figure out how to get around a stupid regulation or how not to get into trouble, how not to get your name in the newspaper, right? My uncle, who is a country lawyer, used to say, yeah, you could do that, but you might get your name in the paper, which is usually enough to stop me from any thoughts of doing it. And you and I, we've both seen a lot of people get their names in the paper, even if they didn't pay the ultimate price. So that's got to be a bit of a relief that you don't have to lock heads with our regulatory betters, whether they're in wherever they might be, in Canada, in the U.S., or wherever. I mean, that's got to be a major burden off your shoulders.
Don't just survive. Thrive, the Financial Survival Network.
Doré Copper Mining is a premier, near-term, high-grade copper and gold redevelopment opportunity with tremendous exploration potential only 14 kilometers from the town of Chibougamau in mine-friendly Quebec. Doré Copper is debt-free and owns a 2,700-ton-per-day mill with an 8-million-ton tailings facility ready to be used. There is already power to site and it is accessible by paved highway and rail. Doré Copper aims to produce a profitable hub-and-spoke operation of over 100,000 gold equivalent ounces per year or over 60 million pounds of copper equivalent by 2024. Because of the existing infrastructure and location, a low capex is anticipated to recommence production. Doré Copper trades under DCMC in Toronto and under DRCMF on the OTC. To learn more, go to dorecopper.com. That's dorecopper.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
It is. It's interesting that normally when I meet the regulators as human beings, one-on-one, I invariably like them. I always suspect that I'll dislike them. You know, I always suspect that they're sort of ogres or vampires or something. And the people who work for the regulatory authorities and the internal compliance people within Sprott, I've always found to be reasonably pleasant people and even reasonable people, given what it is that they have to do for a living. But hopefully my interaction with them in the future will be over beer or coffee at a conference or something like that, rather than across the table discussing some alleged infraction. The other thing is simply not having to consider some aspects of regulation in an interview like this. Not being regulated means, with the proper disclaimer, I can talk about a company without it being deemed to be investment advice. Some of the best help that I can give people, or could have given people over the last 30 years, I was constrained from being able to give as a consequence of what I did for a living. And those shackles come off March 15th, which I'm looking forward to.
Hey, the exactly a month to the day before tax day. So
I haven't managed to shed that shackle, Gary. I'm sorry.
Death and taxes, unavoidable. And so now that you're free to actually say what's on your mind, what's the one thing, like, well, you can't say it yet because you still got a couple of days. You got 6 days, so you got to watch your step here, Rick.
Well, I would say the biggest things on my mind aren't necessarily to do with individual companies. The biggest things on my mind are the same things that you and I always discuss. Artificially low interest rates, negative real yield, which really is part of the democratic process of a war on savers by spenders, spenders being very negative, numerous. Debt and deficits, as we described earlier, a transfer of wealth from young people to old people, and quantitative easing, which, as you and I have discussed, if it was described correctly, would be called counterfeiting. All of those things bother me from the point of view of being a financial advisor, and they bother me from the point of view of being a human being. I would say the one other thing that I like to talk about on shows like yours is the necessity of investors who are looking to protect themselves against those things, that they be less narrative, less story focused, and more arithmetically and economically focused. One thing that you see is that when a narrative takes hold, sometimes, in particular microcap stocks, the valuations get so excessive that rather than offering you protection, they offer you substantial additional risk. And, you know, we've just been through a period like that where the junior valuations in the resource sector got to be stupid. It's interesting to me that so many speculators see a stock that was selling for a dollar and is now selling for 50 cents, where nothing has changed, and they see it being less attractive at half the price, when arithmetically the opposite is true. And hopefully I'll be able to get that message across more efficiently with specific examples once some of the regulatory shackles are removed from me.
Yeah, that's so funny. That is a paradox of investing, is that the less popular something is, the more that its price has been driven down, the less attractive it is. And people want to grab onto Tesla or the latest flavor of the month. And you've seen a lot of them during your career and because they're going up, whereas to buy something before it goes up, for some reason, the average investor cannot fathom the possibility of that.
It is interesting that we're normally fairly rational when we buy consumer goods, even consumer durables, and we're not so rational when we buy financial assets. Probably the fact that I learned that lesson myself 40 years ago has been as responsible for my success as any hard work or curiosity I might have exhibited.
Yeah, well, I've relearned that lesson too many times to count here, but I finally feel like I've learned it once and for all. But we'll see what happens next. Hey, one thing we never really talk about, but a lot of investing is physiology. All right, pain, the chemicals that your brain produces to cause pain, both emotional and physical, last a lot longer than the pleasure chemicals like dopamine, where it lasts a very short period of time and you keep needing more. And, you know, I always go back to what you said, never mistake a a bull market for brains or genius. And, you know, when those stocks are going up and you see a day where you go up 15-20%, man, the dopamine really kicks in and you just want more of it and more of it. How do you counteract the physiological drivers here that cause you to make bad decisions, because they really do affect your emotions?
Well, I don't always get it right, for one thing. Your suggestion was very generous, but somewhat untrue. Emotions play on me like other people. I am sensible enough to know that recency bias pollutes all humans, which is to say their most recent experience is the one that plays the most heavily on their emotion, rather than experiences that have taken place over time. So if I'm feeling really particularly smart these days, I use that as a self signal. If things have been, from my point of view, too generous to me recently, relative to my experience over 2 or 3 years, I take that as a signal that I need to lighten up. The other thing is, when I look at a market and there isn't very much to buy, that is, the valuations are such that it's difficult for me to allocate fresh capital, I use that as a signal to sell, because it tells me that the stuff that's already in my portfolio that I have a psychological investment in probably reflects the overall market with regards to valuation. That's the thing I got wrong in. That's the thing I got wrong in 2008. I did a pretty good job coming into 2008, knowing that valuations and resources were excessive, and I sold about, I don't know, 30-35% of my positions. Why didn't I sell 70 or 75? If there was nothing to buy, why was I holding stuff? If you don't sell it, you bought it, and a lot of people don't recognize that. Every day you have a choice between having the paper or having the money. And any day you don't take the money, you rebought the paper.
That's so true. You make a decision by not making a decision. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of you out there forget or never realize, that the decision not to act, the decision to act is one decision, but the decision not to act or not acting is actually another decision. Hey, so let's just bring it current to Robinhood, to all of these kids. Like, they think that investing is going on the app and going on the Reddit board and saying, who can we, what shorts can we route today? Or what is everybody else saying? That type of consensus investing generally doesn't end up well, does it?
Well, I have two answers to that. In the near term, no. They're going to make the same mistakes that we did. But they're making them earlier than we did, which is a good thing. The fact that they're going to make these mistakes now, and the fact that they're involved in the game when they're 18, 19, 20, I think is a very good thing. Longer term, I'm extremely bullish as a consequence of Reddit. I'm extremely bullish, too, because the way that the distribution of information is occurring through channels like yours. When you and I were young men, Carrie, I realize that was in the Paleolithic, but when we were young men,
long time ago.
Information came from the top down. It was fed to us by government, by academia, by the major media companies, or investment information came to us from the investment banks, who occasionally didn't have our best interests at hand. Today, information comes from thousands of informal media sources, yourself included, and it comes peer-to-peer. And in fact, knowledge is less important, because most of the knowledge in the world is on Google. You just have to know how to get it. So the fact that these kids, as we call them, of course, when you're my age, people who are damn near dead are still kids. But
same here.
You know, the fact that these young people are learning to harness technology and generate peer-to-peer and multiple sources of information and paradigm, I think is very, very, very good. Their learning process is going to be messy, but listen, Carrie, when I was 29 in my learning process, I went sub-zero. I went to a fairly substantial negative net worth. So it's going to be difficult for me to criticize some kid who puts up 1,100 and loses 1,100. when you look at what I did.
Yeah, same here. I mean, same here. Yeah. Better to do it younger where the losses are more manageable, even though they might hurt more than they do later on. But a loss always is painful. And that's the thing, like failure. Failure is an indispensable element to success. You cannot succeed if you don't fail. When you fail, you know, your best course of action is to minimize your risk and limit your failure. But if you didn't fail, you'd never be in a position to be successful.
You know, my partner and mentor, Eric Sprott, told me probably 20 years ago, he said, a succession of 30% losses is the price you pay for a 2,000% gain. If you aren't in the game as a speculator anticipating taking 20 and 30 and 35% losses more frequently than you enjoy wins, that is, if you can't take the psychological trauma of being wrong more often than you're right, you don't have the opportunity to participate in the asymptomatic math of a 2,000% win. Amortizing a whole bunch of 20 and 30% losses and leaving room left over for acceptable rates of return. So what you say about failure and trauma being the price of success is precisely true, particularly as a speculator or an entrepreneur.
And I think that's one of the errors of maybe our generation raising children, not myself particular, is that didn't let our children taste or appreciate the benefits of failure. Lee Iacocca used to say when he was turning around Chrysler or afterwards, we had the benefit of adversity, and and we took full advantage of it. And maybe that's the biggest lesson here is stock market crashes will come and go, but whether or not you learn from them or keep repeating the mistakes of prior years is really determines whether or not you're going to have a successful investing career. And effectively what our society's done is they've made all of us investors. Whether you want to admit that you're an investor or not, you're still an investor, and you're either going to invest in yourself, probably the best return you can get, or you're going to reinvest in other things. Some of them are going to work out, some of them are not. But the key is to keep increasing the knowledge, I guess, and learning from the experience. So your entity, the company that you're creating, just tell us where we're going to find that.
Well, the media company, I don't actually know where you're going to find it, to be completely honest with you. If you want to stay in touch with me, the easiest way to do it is probably my personal email, rule, R-R-U-L-E, at sprottglobal.com. I haven't really decided what shape it's going to take. I'll be working on it as opposed to working to form it in the interim. As always, too, I invite your audience, Carrie, to find me in a very specific form, because I always am willing to rank people's natural resource stocks portfolios. They can go to a web form, sprottusa.com/rankings. I will rank people's natural resource portfolios, 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst, and comment on individual issues where I think that's important. And people can stay in touch with me through that mechanism as well.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to when you have the whole operation set up and
I'm told it's going to be called Rule Investment Media. People who are smarter than I in both branding and legal have come up with that. I'm not sure how.
Okay. Well, always my father taught me a long time ago it's an old Confucius saying, but basically you got to know that you don't know and find the people who do know. And when I failed, it's because I've often thought I did know and I really didn't. But reality has a way of educating you whether you want to be or not. And I have a feeling, Rick, I'm going to make this bet with you now, that I don't know about monetarily or materially how successful this endeavor is going to be, but from a personal satisfaction standpoint, you're a natural born communicator. And this is going to be the most successful part segment of your life once you really get into it and you do it, because passion will take you very far in life.
You know, I have reasonable financial goals for it. They're sort of amorphous. But one of the things I've learned about communication is I like teaching and I like mentoring. I've been in touch with, I don't know, probably 5,000 millennials in the last 12 months. They would have no use for listening to an old fat bald guy, except they sense I have some credibility because I can help make them some money. And so the idea that I can engage in applied conversations and as a consequence of that mentor means that the non-financial aspects of my future are probably more important to me than the financial aspects of my future. Don't get me wrong, Kerry. You know, this isn't the Red Cross. I'll find a way to make some money out of it. But I'm by now less concerned about that.
I have a feeling this could be the Colonel Sanders of new media that I'm talking to here. And you'll just have to go get your white suit and hat, and you'll be all set. Well, we really appreciate you coming here. Anybody questions for Rick, you can send your email to him, or just send us an email to kl@kerrylutz.com. We'll forward it off to him. Rick, best luck here. Thank you for all of the generosity that you've provided me with over the past 10 years. It's been a real learning experience. I know you're a quote collector like I am, and I've been collecting your quotes as you've been kind enough to disperse them, and they're indelibly etched upon my brain, and no doubt we'll be crossing paths again in your new career.
Hopefully frequently. I should point out to your audience, too, that despite the fact that I'm retiring, what I'm drinking is sparkling water, not beer. I haven't descended yet to alcoholism during during discussions like this.
Yeah, same here. Well, appreciate it, and we'll talk to you real soon. Great luck.
Thanks, Kerry.
Thanks for listening to Kerry Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to FinancialSurvivalNetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.